bright man. You'll catch that really quickly. And he enjoys interaction. So with that, Chris, please come on up. Let's give Chris a hand and thank him for bringing us here.
Hello, everybody. I'm so grateful to be given the opportunity to come speak here. I love the topic that we're going to talk on. Forgive me if I nerd out a little bit. But this is a tough topic. So I've named this talk The Joyful Cosmology. So cosmology is a really big topic, and it was really hard narrowing down this topic for a talk because we could just go all day. But I'm curious, when we hear the word cosmology, what comes to mind? How would you all define that? Anyone?
The universe.
Mm.
I was going to say the same thing, stars and planets and the universe.
Yeah. It's a pretty broad topic. Yeah, so cosmology is a really big topic, and as we engage it as Christians within apologetics, we tend to look at it as origin, right? We look at the debate between creationism, Darwinism, and that's really important. That's a very important part of cosmology. But cosmology is a very big topic. It actually includes metaphysics, ultimate reality. And it asks, what is the nature of reality? And it's more than a question of composition. It's a question of ultimate meaning. And the problem with us modern Christians is we tend to be more modern than we are Christian in our perspective of reality. So the purpose of this talk, I'm hoping, is to compare and contrast the ancient view of the world, ancient cosmology, with modern cosmology, our modern view of reality, so that we might be re-enchanted to have our imaginations baptized, so to speak, with the joyful cosmology of Christianity, which gives us a whole new perspective on the meaning of heaven and earth, and most importantly, our meaning as persons. So to begin this, I'm going to start with a little exercise here. It should be fun. And before we get into it, I'll just kind of give you some context. There's a test that psychologists use with children to determine what type of thinkers they are. And this is really interesting. What they do is they will take several objects, and they will give the children two boxes, and they will tell the children to place these objects in the boxes, to arrange them and organize them. So what they'll give the children, they'll give them a baseball, they'll give them a baseball bat, then they'll give them a basketball, and then a basketball net. And what they found is that one group of the children would take the basketball and the baseball, and they'd put those in one box, and then they would take the baseball bat and the baseball net, and they'd put those in the second box. Now, it's interesting because some of us might have done it a different way, but what that tells us is that the children that categorized those things and arranged them in that way, they are what are called structuralists. So they saw the structure of the balls, sharing that common structure. So they decided these things are similar in structure, so I'm going to put it in one box, and everything that isn't a sphere is going to go in another box. So what they found with the second group of children was they took the baseball and the baseball bat, and they put that into one box, and then they took the basketball and the net, and they put that in the other box. And what they found is that this is what are called functionalists, because the way that they would organize these objects is based on their function. So the common things shared between these objects, baseball, the game of baseball, playing baseball, and playing basketball. So we're going to do a little exercise here, and I'm going to have you organize some concepts. So we're going to take science, religion, technology, and magic. And we're going to put these into two categories. So, by a show of hands, how many of you would put science with technology and religion with magic? Okay, good number of you. All right. Now, this is actually a structuralist view, because science and technology, those things are testable by empirical science, right? They're tangible. You can test and feel them, observe them. Religion and magic are not tangible things that can be subjected to the empirical sciences. So composition, in a way, structure, is what really determines this distinction. Now, how many of you would categorize science with religion and technology with magic? Okay. Now, this is a functionalist view. And it views science and religion as disciplines that allow us to correlate the mind with ultimate reality. And technology and magic, in contrast, their function are to subdue reality to our own wishes. So one, these disciplines, science and religion, comprehend ultimate reality, and then technology and magic is, in a way, reversed in function. It's to subdue reality. And this is an important distinction because this really helps us understand one of the fundamental distinctions between the ancient way of seeing the world and our modern view of the world. So, bear with me here. We're tackling some tough topics. We're going to use another exercise here to really understand what we're getting out here. So, are any of you familiar with Aristotle's four causes? Got a hand? Yeah. So I'm going to give you a visual representation here to further understand what we mean by function and how that was important to the ancient worldview. So how it was important is they saw the nature of being, ontology. What was most important about the nature of being was function. Whereas we, in the modern world, we tend to place emphasis on the nature of being in its composition, what we can test by science, how we understand the relationship of its composition with other things. So here's another example here. We're going to get into Aristotle's four causes by using the example of a chair. So Aristotle said that there are four things that make up every single thing that exists. Four causes. So don't let that word causes confuse you. It just means how we understand the nature of a thing. So we're going to look at a chair. So the first cause is what he called a natural cause. And a natural cause is the matter from which a thing is made of. So for a chair, that would be the wood, its physical composition. And again, as modern people, we place a lot of importance on natural causes because science almost exclusively deals with this. Now, the second cause he called an efficient cause. And an efficient cause in relation to a chair is the agent that brings it about. So we see here we have a carpenter making the chair. He's bringing that chair into existence. He's the efficient cause. And again, to us modern people, that this relationship of cause and effect is very important to science, right? We observe that in the world. Understanding the universe, we look at causes and effects. Now, the next cause, it's called a formal cause. And a formal cause is the kind of thing that something is. So for this, it's a chair. Now, the difference between, it might be a little confusing understanding the difference between a natural cause and a formal cause. Now, again, natural cause is the composition, the matter from which the thing is made of, which is wood. But formal cause is not what the chair is made of, it's the kind of thing a chair is. So it's the shape of the chair. So there might be different types of chairs. We have a rocking chair, a reclining chair, a stool. And in this case, we have this kind of chair. Now, this is a little bit more limited in a scientific worldview because science deals with strictly material things. We might categorize things in biology according to family, genus, species, or in chemistry, gases, solids, liquids. So there's distinction in the form of things, but it's very much within a material or physical sense. So form is a little bit more abstract, and it's typically what philosophers would deal with. Now, the last category is final cause. And a final cause is the goal or purpose a thing moves toward. So for a chair, its final cause, its function, its ultimate purpose is to sit on. And this is where we have the most important distinction between the ancient and modern world, because function, again, was essential to being. And in a modern world where we place emphasis on empirical sciences and reason, we don't tend to deal with that category a whole lot, because science as an empirical method can't establish value or ultimate purpose. So there's a quote by Joseph Campbell. Some of you might have heard his name. He's a man who is recognized for being a leading authority on myth, mythology, and human experience. And he had this to say. He said, "Life has no meaning. Each of us has meaning, and we bring it to life. It is a waste to be asking the question when you are the answer." Yeah. So this is kind of ironic here, because here's a man, Campbell, who is studying the perspective of the ancient world, looking at mythology. He, of all people, should have been able to understand that function is what's central to the ancient perspective in the nature of being. And yet the way that he concludes, or the conclusion that he comes to about the ancient world and myth, he actually interprets it through the lens of modernity. And he is saying, essentially what we have here is existentialism, that there is no ultimate purpose. There are no final causes. We have to look within this life, our own experiences, and that's what gives us meaning. But again, this is really a breakaway from the ancient world, because these things that Joseph Campbell would recognize as archetypes, like gods, rituals, the temple, all of that, the ancient way of doing life and seeing the gods, that those are merely projections of human desire. And that when we look at these things, these projections, and how they correspond to their rituals, their temples, their belief in the gods, that there is really no substance to that. There's no reality there. Again, they're merely projections. And all that really exists are these desires within human experience. So again, we see this breakaway from the ancient way of seeing meaning and the essence of our nature as people, and how they viewed the world versus our own kind of view today. So again, what we have is Campbell actually reversed the ancient cosmology and redefined myth in a modern way. And this is interesting, because now we're going to get into myth. Joseph Campbell, he studied myth, and he reversed the way that they saw the world. But we're going to understand a little bit more about myth. When we talk about myth, when you say the word myth, what comes to mind? How would you all define that term?
Stories that have been handed down, maybe like folk tales. Hmm. Their ideas about broad concepts.
Okay.
Fable, unreality.
Okay. You and then.
Story with me.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be a real story, or they make that story out. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah. Gods and heroes.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a pattern here. Yep.
If they're using the microphone, just
like
what they say.
Okay. Yeah. Are you all able to to hear some of the answers being thrown out here? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, so you all are describing a pattern here, that we have heroes, we have gods. These are stories passed down that are full of meaning. We have these ultimate questions being asked. But these stories might be true, they might not be true. And you guys are doing a great job. This is actually really what we get to with the essence of myth. And again, Campbell would look at that as merely projecting these desires. But the ancient world, yes, they used myth as a way to raise the ultimate questions. But what was so fundamental to myth was that they saw the answer to these questions, meaning, life, existence, that was tied with the heavens and the gods. There wasn't a separation. There was separation between heaven and earth, but the answers to these ultimate questions all depend on the gods and heaven. And again, Campbell would say those things are merely projections. They don't actually exist. But the ancient world would say otherwise. And just to give some examples of myth here, again, myth is something not necessarily literally true, but they convey deep truths. And some examples of this are the flood myths and even the creation myths. The Egyptian Ra versus Apep, we have chaos represented as a serpent being overcome, and out of that comes order at creation. We also have the Babylonian Marduk versus Tiamat, same thing, chaos serpent being conquered for the sake of creation and order. In the Greek tradition, we have Zeus and Typhon. The Canaanite tradition, we have Baal versus Yam. And in the Norse tradition, we have Thor versus Jörmungandr. It's an interesting name. But specifically here, this picture that we're looking at, this is the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is actually a flood story. So what we're seeing here is a pattern that conveys a deep truth about the world that might have different details. So we might look at these things as being corrupted because they've attributed different gods and details to the story, but there's a general truth to it. Because Genesis, in the beginning, we have the Spirit of God hovering over the waters, chaos, and out of that comes order. So again, we have a general truth here, but misattributed to other gods. Now here in the Gilgamesh account, we have another flood story. And as you probably all know, there are flood accounts from all major civilizations throughout history. But as we know as Christians, through Scripture, we know that this is merely a representation of Noah and the flood, the destruction of the world. So myth played an important role in the ancient world because it's raising these ultimate questions. And during the time of the early church, one of the most popular religious systems was Gnosticism. That was in the 1st and 2nd century AD. And what was so particular about Gnosticism was its particular view of the world. So again, it had its own way of answering the state of the world based on the gods. So Gnosticism saw the world as created by lesser divine beings who were imperfect. And because of this imperfection, when they created the world was also imperfect. So what they're doing is they're explaining suffering in this world, why the world is not a good place, because it's created by imperfect gods. Which makes sense. Again, you have heaven and the gods affecting the earth. So they saw the body and the material world as corrupted. And one attained salvation through what's called gnosis, knowledge, which allowed someone to transcend the mortal body, the physical world, and become one with a spiritual reality. Salvation through knowledge. Does that sound familiar? It should, because that was the lie in Eden. The serpent said, if you eat of this tree and gain knowledge, you can become like God. So we see some overlap here with Gnosticism. But again, the reality of suffering in the world is directly tied to a spiritual reality. So the question is this difference between the ancient perspective and understanding function and meaning, purpose in the world as being tied with a transcendent reality, God and heaven. At some point, we as modern people broke away from that perspective. So where did this all go wrong? Does anybody know what this image is? It's a famous painting. Yeah, it looks familiar. This is Raphael's School of Athens. Very, very popular painting. We could spend all day breaking down its meaning, but we're going to look specifically at what's the focus at the very center of this. Okay, we have two people here. The one on the left, that's Plato. And on the right, that's Aristotle. And they're doing something with their hands, and this is very meaningful. I'll blow it up here so you maybe have a closer picture. Plato's pointing up, and Aristotle is pointing down here. And what this represents, Plato, he was all about the world of forms, the transcendent universals, right? We have these categories in the mind that correspond to these forms in a transcendent reality. And then we have Aristotle, his student, who disagreed with these forms and these universals. He's pointing down here at human experience, the world of particulars and all that can be experienced in the world in the way that we come to an understanding of ultimate reality. Now, what's interesting about this is this divide, they were aware of the distinction between transcendent reality and the particulars of here and human experience, but this divide widened with the Enlightenment. And by the time of the Enlightenment, we had the elevation of human reason and empirical sciences as that which gave us truth about the world we live in. And again, these are important concepts. I'm grateful for science. I'm grateful for human reason. But because it was elevated to the point where that alone gave us knowledge of the world that we live in, what happened is we saw this greater divide between the transcendent world of spirit and heaven become distinct from this world of material causes. Again, going back to Aristotle and the causes, we're more concerned with the composition of reality, what's testable by reason and science, than we are with these other things that don't really, they can't be tested or proven by reason or science. So we just kind of ejected that view of the world. And again, one of the consequences of this is that this allowed us to see the world in a way that meaning, ultimate purpose, isn't found above in heaven or from God, but it's found within this world. So in a way, we've kind of sided with Aristotle. And that's a generalization of Aristotle. He's a complicated guy, but in the particulars of this life and human experience, it's definitely where we've landed as modern people. So this is really what's brought us to this place of a structuralist view, going back to our little exercise, rather than a functionalist view. And from here on, when we're looking at the effects of this divide, we're going to look at Lewis, C.S. Lewis. He's a great mind that understood this separation, and he attempted throughout his life to try and reconcile our modern world with an ancient perspective. So again, if you recall our little exercise, according to a functionalist view, science and religion are meant to give us an ability to relate our minds to ultimate reality. Technology and magic subdue reality to our wishes. So this is what Lewis has to say connecting these two. He says, there is something that unites magic and applied science, technology, while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality. and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique, and both, in the practice of this technique, are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious. Now, one of the important things that I think kind of emerges from understanding this attempt to dominate creation, God gave us dominion over the earth. That was one of the sacred duties entrusted to humanity, and we know sin disrupted that. But with Lewis's observation and how applied science, technology, and even magic are used now, we have a shift from dominion, where we steward the earth in our priestly duty, but now there's this conquest of nature. And that's a big deal, because what we're seeing ultimately, if we remember Gnosticism was false. We can all agree on that. But there was still some truth in it, in that it looked to a transcendent reality, the spiritual realm, as having some good, and that from that reality came salvation, or at least some reconciliation to the suffering in the world. But with this modern perspective, it's become inverted. Instead of looking to a transcendent reality, we now look within this life, within our own conquest of nature, to find meaning and purpose. And in addition to that, really what we see is, as part of that inversion, the way that the modern mind regards religion, instead of seeing it as the answer that fulfills meaning and purpose, it's at best seen as something that is suspect. We have skepticism toward it. Or at worst, we see it as being the cause of suffering, right? A lot of people would say religion is the reason for suffering in this world. And that's because we've inverted this view of the world. And I find this interesting, because when Jesus was in the wilderness, he faced three temptations. And the very first temptation, if you recall, Satan tempted him to turn these stones into bread. And there's a lot of meaning to that, because the assumption Satan was making is that man's need is fundamentally material, that he can deceive humanity into thinking, your need is only material, that's what's most important. But Jesus responded, he said, no. What is fundamental is the spiritual need, right? Man does not live on bread alone, but every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And later, he would actually go on to say that he is the bread of life himself. But as we can see, I think the modern world has bought into that lie, that our salvation, our meaning, our purpose in this life is found here and now in this world. And again, we're seeing this separation from the old world, the ancient cosmology, from a modern perspective. Now, as we mentioned, a big reason for this divide came through the Enlightenment. This elevation of reason, human experience, empirical sciences to determine what's true. And as a result of that, we treat this world as its own independent sphere of influence, and heaven and all that isn't testable according to that process as something that we kind of hold suspect. But through that, we've reduced reality to merely natural causes, right? We look at the composition of reality as something that's fundamental to its being. And again, C.S. Lewis has a great observation on the consequences of this. He says, when we understand a thing analytically and then dominate it and use it for our own convenience, we reduce it to a level of nature in the sense that we suspend our judgments of value about it, ignore its final cause, if any, and treat it in terms of quantity. This repression of elements and what would otherwise be our total reaction to it is sometimes very noticeable and even painful. Something has to be overcome before we can cut up a dead man or a live animal in a dissecting room. These objects resist the reductionistic movement of the mind, whereby we thrust them into the world of mere nature. So what Lewis is saying here, he's saying that as a consequence of this perspective of reality, we've reduced it to something less than it actually is. He's saying we are no longer thinking of things in terms of their value, but merely their composition. Is this making sense? Yeah, so again, we've lost final cause, ultimate purpose, function. We see things as purely mechanistic. And again, Lewis goes on. He says, the great minds know very well that the object so treated, an object being reduced, is an artificial abstraction, that something of its reality has been lost. From this point of view, the conquest of nature appears in a new light. We reduce things to mere nature in order that we may conquer them. We are always conquering nature because nature is the name for what we have, to some extent, conquered. The price of conquest is to treat a thing as mere nature. Yes?
That slide before that, I'm having trouble with the second to the last sentence, or the one before that.
Having a hard time with the second sentence.
Are we doing the mic?
That's okay.
The previous slide, I think.
Beginning at the repression of elements. This slide?
Yeah. No. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Can't write it down. Yeah, C.S. Lewis is a little difficult at times.
Oh, absolutely.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. Is that?
Is there one more? Yeah. What does that mean? Especially the last sentence there. The magic and applied science alike. The problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes.
Yeah, that's my typo.
The solution is a technique and both. In the practice of the technique, are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and bias.
No, don't be sorry. That's a great question. So what Lewis is doing is he's recognizing a relationship between applied science, technology, and magic, and that they are being used to subdue reality to the wishes of men, which, because we're sinful, fallen creatures, he's saying we use for evil. So this technique, the practice of the technique and using magic and technology, that they're ready to do things disgusting and pious. We're ready to violate the sacred nature of reality, of creation, in order to fulfill our sinful desires. So does that make more sense? Yeah. So going back to that divide between science, religion, technology, magic, he's saying that technology and magic functionally are used in this world to corrupt, to conquer, to subdue reality to our wishes. Yeah. Great question. Thanks for asking it. And yeah, please let me know if there's a concept that just goes woof, because yeah, we're doing some heavy lifting here, and I thank you all for sitting through it, because this is really abstract. But I promise you it has some very practical consequences in the way that we live our lives. I'm just trying to find where we were at. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, back to that slide. Technology is discussed. I would say technology is neutral. It can be used for either good or evil. Magic could be said to be not neutral because it's always... it has an aim to deceive.
Mm.
So magic, I go with you on that one, but the technology, I don't know, I love technology, but it seems neutral. I mean,
sure.
I love it because I can do good with it.
I agree.
Someone else loves it because they can do evil with it.
I agree. And I would say that those are neutral things, but Lewis is merely observing that inevitably, in our modern age specifically, we could recognize all the good that it's done, but as we move forward as a society, ultimately, we're going deeper into secularism. And part of the instrument of that transition is technology. So again, I agree, it's a neutral thing, but ultimately, because of our fallen nature, it inevitably is used for corruption. So that's a great point, though. So what we find in our modern cosmology is, let's see here, in our other debates between Darwinism, creationism, this modern cosmology of secularism that we hear all over the place, it dominates universities, is that it tells us that because of a cosmic accident that life emerged, but we are ultimately a meaningless ball spinning in the vast nothingness of space. Right? As Campbell said, life has no meaning. So again, we have the consequence here, even cosmologically. Our own modern cosmology tells us it's removed heaven, it's removed God, which ultimately removes purpose. And that's a pretty depressing cosmology, if you ask me, and I'm sure you all would agree. And I think this is interesting because this actually, it corresponds to one of the most famous questions that Jesus ever raised. And Jesus said, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul?" So I know we have there's a lot of applications to that, but looking at the implications of that question at cosmology, meaning, purpose, as Lewis said, we're trying to conquer nature. We're no longer stewards of it, offering it up as part of our priestly duty to worship God. We're trying to conquer it. We're trying to find our salvation through it. It's that first temptation again. We want our daily bread because we think by it we find salvation. But what's interesting here with what Jesus said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world? Well, through our conquest, we're trying to gain the whole world. And we know we won't find our own souls, we won't find salvation. But ironically, in that pursuit, the consequence of that is it robs creation of its soul. I mean, it robs it of its ultimate purpose. It merely treats it as a means to an end. It's lost all ultimate meaning because it no longer has any value apart from how it fulfills our desires. It's a corruption. And that's really sad. But it shows us the heinousness of sin and how we've gotten here, how through the history of thought in the modern world. Yes, sir. I'm going to wait for Mike.
Exactly the direction you're heading, but keeps coming to mind is Aristotle brought up the final cause and agent cause, and for some reason science didn't take that up. They went with, what's the material, and how do we use this stuff? I don't know, from C.S. Lewis, I read through a couple of his books, but I didn't hear how he addressed that issue. Why did a final cause that Greeks brought up and agent cause, which maybe they're trying to get away from because of the ancient gods, when they really started their sciences, why didn't we also take the final cause in modern sciences? That is something that looks like we dropped.
Yeah, totally. Are you all familiar with David Hume? He was famous for saying he had what's called fact-value dichotomy. You can't get an ought from an is. You can't get values from facts. Is that ringing a bell to anyone? All right, well, I'll kind of explain it here because I think it answers the question. David Hume, he said, we can observe things within reality, facts, right? Empirical facts, scientific facts, or even just propositional facts about reality. Like, my cup is sitting here on this podium. But he's saying that merely stating facts does not give them value. You can't derive any value from stating facts. The category of value itself is entirely other. And that's really the divide between final causes and these other types of causes, is merely stating the facts of natural cause, right? The physical composition of this thing, or even an efficient cause, how it got here, or even its form, just stating the fact that this is a tumbler. that in itself does not in any way give it value. And final cause is another category in itself, but because science as an empirical method can't give us value, it's treated as its own category for philosophy or the existentialists. But does that make sense? I mean, it's really interesting seeing this, because I think, you know, as people, because we were created for ultimate meaning, even though we can't get it, we still look for it. We're still driven by the purpose of life to find meaning. And so even though it's not there, it's not, those answers don't come from science per se in answering questions of value, we still seek it. So I want to, the next segment of this, what I really want to shift to is, how do we recover this joy, right? Because at the beginning of this, I said we live in a disenchanted world. And by disenchanted, it's we don't really think in terms of the old world, where we understand that everyday life is tied with heaven and the gods, this transcendent reality. And that's not to say that we don't believe that, because as Christians, that's fundamental to our faith. We believe in heaven, God, and all of that, but functionally, we still live with this mindset. And, you know, as I was researching this and as I've been reading all of these books, it was really convicting to me, because I see all the areas where I've still bought into this and the way that I view the world. So another thing I want to clarify, this doesn't mean that I'm anti-science. We love science. I think it's a valuable tool to bring us to knowledge of the universe. But when we take that as the whole of reality and the way that we come to understand it, it's like looking with one eye covered up. We're blind to so much. And I think that's what Lewis was trying to say, is that we've reduced reality to mere parts, mere nature. And there's so much more to it. And that's where I think we can regain this enchantment from the Christian worldview, because it goes a step beyond these ancient cosmologies. It's a joyful cosmology. There's something lost here we're trying to recover, and I think that there's something within these myths that we can really glean from. And one of the things I love about C.S. Lewis is he understood this problem, and he wrote a lot of fictional books. And I think what he was trying to do was what the ancient world did by raising these ultimate questions in myth, he was trying to do with fantasy and fairy tales. And as we read some of this, we kind of catch glimpses of what's been lost, that joy. And one of my favorite philosophers, he has this to say about it. He says, "We have all breathed that modern air, even those who disbelieve it or even despise it. Our lungs are full of reductionism, which is dead air. Then suddenly, a gust of wet, salty air blows in from the sea, and our spirits spring up like children, full of mysterious joy. A smell from another country, a gleam of celestial beauty, falling on our jungle of filth and imbecility." That's beautiful. But some of that language, it just doesn't have the same effect on our hearts. It doesn't compel us. And I think that's sad, because really that's how we ought to see the world, in the fullness of its beauty and goodness. So I want to look at some of the biblical perspective that assumes this ancient perspective that is the answer to finding this re-enchantment in the world. And what we find is the ancient world's obsessed with temples, rituals, sacrifice, idols. And, you know, we might have some understanding of that because of our Christian faith, but overall, I think we tend to kind of dismiss that as mere superstition. We kind of, to a degree, buy into what Campbell says, that these are projections. This is the ignorant practice of a pre-scientific age. And I grant that even I have that perspective oftentimes from the ancient worldview to think, well, you know, they didn't have science, they didn't have our modern understanding of the world, which gives explanation as to why they would have done such things. But our Bible is written in that worldview, and I would suggest that those aren't merely ignorant practices that have no reality, but when we look at these things, we have to ask, where did these ideas come from? They didn't just drop out of the sky. It implies that there's a real reality behind it. And so I'm going to take a look at Genesis. So right at the beginning in Genesis, we have a cosmology, another kind of ancient myth, not that it's untrue, but it captures truth. And again, we have the spirit hovering over the waters, chaos, and out of that chaos comes order as God creates. He establishes a created order. And right at the beginning of this, we also have a temple. And in the ancient world, gardens, mountains, they were holy places, sacred places. And temples were meant to be the dwelling place of gods. And the way that our Bible tells us in Genesis is that the first temple was Eden. This was where God dwelled with humanity. And the whole purpose to creation was to expand that temple upon the earth. So again, as we look at myth as from the ancient world, as looking to a transcendent reality of heaven and the gods, that from that came function and purpose. And that's no different from Scripture, because at creation, in Eden, God gives humanity function. He gives them purpose. He gives them their final cause. And he says, be fruitful, multiply, procreate, have dominion over the earth. He's saying, I want the boundaries, the walls of Eden to expand and fill the entire earth. And nothing's changed. God's plan is still to fulfill that purpose. But again, I think a lot of this is lost on us as modern people because it's in the language of the ancient world where we don't really see the significance of temples. But as we continue down in Scripture, we still see temples showing up. God, when he chose Abraham and then Moses and his people went out into the wilderness to go into the promised land, God gave the instruction to build a tabernacle. Again, we have another temple showing up. God's dwelling with his people, his holy presence. And then eventually with Solomon, we see the building of the temple again. So God is dwelling with his people on the earth, another kind of Eden, so to speak. And this is important because Jesus makes a really startling claim when he came. Let's see if I have these slides in order. Forgive me. Jesus shows up and he says, I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. Because God used to deal with his people by dwelling in temples, but then something crazy happens. God comes in the flesh. We have this new thing greater than a temple. We have a person. We have God dwelling with us as a man. And I think this is incredible because that's exactly what we're celebrating right now, right? This is the reason for this season, as we say. So Christianity is coming on the scene with something radical here. You know, as we looked at Gnosticism, the way that they explained suffering in the world was that, well, these imperfect gods created our world in this mess, so we seek something beyond it to find hope. But Christianity offers a completely different cosmology. It's saying a good God created a good world, but we misused that world and our own freedom to rebel and to sin, and that's the reason why this whole world is messed up. But radically, we have God coming into that world to restore its function and purpose. So again, we have temples, we have all these things, we have Jesus coming, he's something more than a temple here. So where's this going? What's God's plan here? What's at work? Well, again, looking at cosmology, we get a picture of eschatology, where we're headed. And so Jesus, he's God with us, God become man. But then when he dies, something different happens. We have a transition now. And Paul says this. He says, we are now the temple of God. Now, we hear that all the time, and we know what it means. God's Spirit dwells within us, but this is incredible because this is part of God's plan from the beginning. God wants to dwell with his people upon the earth. And when Jesus came, what he's doing is he's restoring that relationship between heaven and earth. And in a way, he's actually creating a greater reality. Because God had Eden. Adam and Eve walked with God. But what we have now is God in us. We partake, we participate in the Godhead. That's a profound mystery. But what that does is it creates in us a... let's see if I have these slides. Sadly, I don't. I'm so sorry. What this does is a merging of heaven and earth. And I want us to understand this concept because this is how the ancient world saw things. And this is really the reality that we're living in as Christians. So the temple was this little overlap between heaven and earth. It was God's space that he occupied to dwell with his people. And now we are these living temples of God. And that's important because what we have now, if you recall, I'm sorry, do you know Leviticus? You know, we have this rule, these laws given, how we go about caring for the temple. You know, some of this is it's kind of boring or confusing even. But God gave that so that he can maintain that space. If it became unclean, he couldn't occupy it. Jesus comes, he says, I tell you something greater than the temple is here. And what he does, as he comes in contact with things that would be considered unclean, things associated with death and the fall, instead of becoming unclean by those things, he himself infects life and restoration into that. And that's incredible because we have a reversal. His life, God invading this world, is a way to redeem it. And now as we have received that same spirit, as we're little temples here on this earth, we're part of that work. That this is the Christian mission, the commission. We are expanding again God's kingdom, the boundaries of Eden upon the earth. As Jesus came in and invaded our world, now he's commissioned us with that same purpose. We are little living temples going out in the work of Christ. And this is something that even Paul mentions in Romans 12. You probably all know the famous verse. He says, if I please have it. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. So we know Romans 12 is we are to present our bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is our spiritual act of worship. Now that can be kind of confusing, but Paul understood that our bodies have a purpose. We are living temples. We're presenting them as a living sacrifice. He's saying that is our spiritual act of worship. And why that's important is because Paul recognizes the reality that we have the Spirit, but that, again, informs us as our function and our purpose here upon the earth with God is that the nature of our worship as these living temples has everything to do with our bodies, right? We're living temples. We have bodies. Present those bodies as a spiritual act of worship. So he's saying that bodies have everything to do with worship. And I know that we tend to think of eschatology, heaven. One day we're all going to go live and be with God in heaven. But that ignores that there's a new heaven and a new earth. Because the body, the resurrection of the body, has everything to do with the nature of our worship. Again, going back to Genesis, God gave us function when he created the temple. He said, have dominion. This is tied to your worship. And I think what that really means, and I think Paul got it too in Romans 12, he's saying that the nature of our worship, what is so unique about us as people, as living temples, having these bodies, is that the nature of our worship has everything to do with those bodies in that God has manifested his goodness and his beauty within creation. And the way that we come to understand that goodness and beauty is with these bodies. We have senses that understand and come to knowledge of God's goodness and beauty in ways that the angels probably don't. Angels are pure minds. They're spirits. And their understanding of God is much different than our own. And I suggest that part of what it means to be imagers of God is that we image him upon the earth in the way that we even use our creative imaginations. Imaginations is taking something that's abstract and making it concrete in our creative capacity. And I believe that that is absolutely fundamental to humanity. It's part of the way that we're able to worship God, and I think why God didn't simply just get rid of the earth, get rid of our bodies, and have us exist in a purely spiritual world. Our bodies are tied to our worship. And as such, Paul says, we are now living in this reality as living temples, submitting our bodies as a living sacrifice. But that connection here between imagination and the way that we live that out here on the earth, that's when he goes on to say, but do not be conformed any longer to the patterns of this world. Right? But we're understanding now the will of God, the mind of God through his Spirit. And the Greek word there, it's metamorphosis, to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that word, we typically associate it with butterflies, caterpillars going through a metamorphosis. And that's good, because it means there's a transformation taking place. And that's very similar to another word that we use, metanoia. That's the word for repentance. And I know that we tend to understand that as a heart of contrition, that we recognize sin and feeling the conviction of sin. But really what the meaning of that word is, metanoia, is to have a change of mind. We're not merely feeling conviction. We are acting in a new way according to a new truth. And that's what Paul is saying here, is this renewing of the mind. We are now having our minds transformed to the point where we're living out of a new reality. We're putting away the old way of seeing the world, the old way that we live. That's passed away. That died with Christ. We're now alive in him as these living temples, and now we are living with the truth and the knowledge of this world that he's given us. But as we go into this season here, I hope this is some of the joyful cosmology that's been passed on to us in the way that we understand even Jesus coming into our world. Because really, it's more than a little baby being born in a stable. It was an act of war. And some of my favorite lyrics to a Christmas song here capture it well. This is war, like you ain't seen. This winter's long, it's cold and mean. With hangdog hearts, we stood condemned. But the tide turns now at Bethlehem. This is war, and born tonight, the Word is flesh, the Lord of light, the Son of God, the lowborn King, whom demons fear, of whom angels sing. This is war on sin and death. The dark will take its final breath. It shakes the earth, confounds all plans, the mystery of God is man. That's beautiful. But we need to live in this reality. The ancient world, I think, fantasy is a fantastic way of kind of learning to see the world the way it was meant to be seen. As Paul says, having our minds renewed. I think part of the way that we've been affected by modernity, this new secular cosmology, is our imaginations have been atrophied. And I think that's part of the way that our minds are renewed, is how we see this as a spiritual reality. Every day we wage spiritual warfare. And we need to live in that reality and understanding that there is an end, and we are now participating in that battle to spread the kingdom of God upon the earth. And as Jesus said, you know, we have to become like children. And I know there are a lot of meanings to that, but I think one of the things that's so characteristic about children is their imaginations. They're so incredible, the way that they imagine and are so creative. And here, you know, that's part of what's been atrophied in our understanding of the world. And I'll just leave with this quote here. Chesterton had a really great way of suggesting one of the ways that we might regain this. He says, because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. But perhaps God is strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately. But he has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. It's incredible. It's really hard to take something this abstract and to condense it down into something practical. But I hope what we take away here is that the way that we do life, instead of seeing the world as these independent spheres of influence, it's hard because we go about our days, we recognize this spiritual realm here on Sundays, but then we go about our week, and it's hard to really see it as a reality day to day. But I hope we can live in that reality. I want us to be able to see how creation itself participates in our worship. This isn't just something that's going to pass away. It has a purpose. There is an ultimate meaning to it. And even as we just sat down this week to enjoy meals, to be thankful, that is an act of worship, to enjoy a meal. We're understanding God's goodness in his creation. You know, it tells us so much about who God is that when we look at creation, we see a God of pleasure. And unfortunately, we've taken these goods of creation and see them as ends in themselves. We're so concerned with this world, and we've lost sight of heaven. But these goods were meant to point us to him. And I hope that we can start living in that reality. Just one practical way is just seeing the things that we enjoy are in themselves acts of worship as it tells us of who God is and points us to him. So thank you so much for bearing with me here. I know this is some heavy stuff, but I'd like to continue in some conversation, if you will, to maybe go through some more of this, because this is a conversation that can be ongoing. Yes, sir.
He doesn't allow angels that. It doesn't appear that he does. Does it have something to do with living in this universe or our eternal tabernacle we reside in? Do you have any ideas on that? Angels only seem to get one chance.
Yeah. Ooh, you dropped the heavy question on me. Well, I can only speculate. Yeah, sure. We can all only speculate until we see the eternal perspective. I think it does. It has to do, I think, with the fact that they inhabit heaven and we inhabit a temporal world. They are pure minds. And I think because of that, they have a perspective of God that we don't, that we will one day have in eternity. But because of that, I think that they, because the mystery of God has been revealed greater to them, because they can stand before his presence and know and see him relationally in that way, there's no way, there's no temporal aspect to their being that can be redeemed in that relationship. Whereas we, occupying a finite world that has time and space and dimension, I think that's it. I think that because we inhabit this world, and I think Lewis kind of gives us a great way of understanding that in his book, The Great Divorce. He said, he's talking about freedom of choice and the nature of our being. You know, do we exist throughout the entirety of time in a temporal world? And what is that implication in eternity, in heaven? And he says, but to raise the question within time and this concept of freedom and becoming, he said, when we look at it from within time, it's like looking through a telescope the opposite way. We only see a very small part. He said, but in eternity, from the eternal perspective, we're given the big picture. And we're able to look back on that time, the consecutive sequences of time, as seeing how they participate in the totality of who we are as eternal beings. But again, taking that abstract thought, I think that really is another way that we're distinguished from angels, in that there is that succession within time, which is fulfilled or actualized from the eternal perspective, where angels already have that. They aren't temporal. So I know that was kind of abstract.
Chris did a marvelous job talking about how we reduce things and take on a reductionist viewpoint with respect to the physical world. How about the application of that same viewpoint to politics? Do we do the same thing with politics? And if we do, what would be a good way for us to get away from that, to see politics as having an end beyond just selfish acquisition?
The politics question. Throwing me the hardball question. No, that is a great question. And I think Pastor Josh and Pastor Robert have been doing a great job tackling this. We actually just did a political disciple symposium really looking at the nature of that question. So I'll do my best to represent some of their brilliant insights. But I think one of the ways the modernity has affected our view of politics, it's kind of going back to that first temptation again. We look to our daily bread, the material things of this world, as answering our spiritual needs. And I think if we take a look at modern politics, we are basically putting our hope in politics that we can find spiritual solutions political solutions to spiritual problems. We see it as some government or some government or some president or some politician is going to somehow solve all these problems. And you know, there might be some truth to that to some degree, but we know ultimately that the true king is Jesus. And his kingdom, while already established, is yet to be fulfilled. So we live in the tension of that. I think we can live out the Christian ethic of love. I think there's a lot of great political theories put forward by Christian thinkers that allow us to live in that tension of occupying a fallen world that is yet to fully be restored. And yet we have one foot in the kingdom in that we understand that there's something greater and beyond it. But I think that that's part of what was tasked to us, is to be ambassadors of that new kingdom insofar as we participate within a culture. And I think what Jesus radically did, you know, he stepped on a lot of toes, even politically. But what he really showed us is that the way to change a culture, even politically, is to not transform it from without or over it as a governing body, because the church isn't a governing body, but it's to transform it within. And I think that really relates to one of the great quotes by Plato. He says that, bear with me, I'm cycling through my brain to try and find it. He says that justice in the life and conduct of the state is possible as only it first resides in the hearts of its citizens. So even Plato understood that, hey, you can have governments, but a polis, a society, is made up of people, and they're only ever going to act as good as what's in their hearts. And I think that's what Jesus was concerned with. He was really wanting to transform the whole of a person from within. But I don't think that's to the exclusion of political participation. I think we ought to be involved, but again, I think we often use the distinctives of political parties to inform our Christianity rather than the other way around. So that's tough, though, living in that tension. Ross.
What Mark is really trying to ask is, should we be Democrats or Republicans?
Chesterton, great quote on that. He said, conservatives want to prevent the problems from being resolved, and progressives want to go on making new problems. So when you look at, I see the intention behind political parties. I mean, I know that there are abuses on both sides, but I think there's valid points on both. We need to conserve truth to, you know, morality, to the values that our entire government was established on, but at the same time, we need to adapt those within a new world, and even help the poor and the oppressed. But because we're fallen people, the ideals of those political parties, I think, are lived out according to our fallen humanity, and that's why we're in the mess we're in. Oh, here it comes.
As I go my day, my week, and I use my cell phone, and I watch TV, and I drive my car, and I use technology, and I'm living my life, how, based on what you said, gave us this morning, which was terrific, how can I think about reality different? What is my view of reality supposed to look like based on what we have in the
Bible? Another heavy question.
You've got 8 minutes to answer.
Y'all are smart. Ross, from what I understand, you're saying, you know, just our day-to-day living and the way we go about our lives, how can we see that in this new perspective of reality that this whole talk was about? How do we practically live that out, and what does that look like according to a biblical worldview? That's something that I struggle with every single day. I'm still figuring this out myself, but I think part of it is understanding that everything we do has meaning. I think we still live with a mindset that there's the sacred and the secular, and we put all of our religious living into one category, like church and ministry and things like this, and then we go throughout our week thinking that, you know, we're just living life. But that living life has everything to do with that spiritual reality. Everything we do, we consume. So one of the things that God established as part of our function in Genesis is that what's fundamental to our being is that we are worshipers. We will always seek to fulfill meaning regardless of whether or not we acknowledge God exists or not, because the most fundamental part of us is that we are worshipers. So the way that we go about our lives, we're worshiping something, and it's not always God. It's not always Jesus. And so to look at our daily lives and the things that we consume with our time, our focus, our energy, to be very mindful of that, to see that these things are participating in something. They have meaning towards some end. And is it part of the kingdom of God as we're becoming more like Jesus and expanding his kingdom on the earth? Or are these things a distraction? Are they idols? Are they part of another kingdom? So those are some of the practical questions I ask myself throughout my day, and that's why you bring God into every moment, to help discern what that is. How are we doing on time?
Just a quick question. I mean, you've been introduced ideas from G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis to explore these questions. Are there other contemporary writers that also try to tackle the issue of the modern mind versus the ancient mind?
Oof.
Lost in that transition?
Yes. And it's such a broad topic, though, because as you guys can tell, we're pulling from a lot of stuff. Because we're tackling the history of thought, we're tackling philosophy, we're talking about all kinds of things. And there's even divides within Christian perspectives. You know, Lewis was an Anglican, Chesterton was a Catholic. They're just all different branches of Christianity at play here. Personally, and this is just my view, Pastor Robert holds a different view. We kind of butt heads sometimes. But one aspect of theology that I really think helps explain how we got to this point, like from a theological perspective, it's something called sacramental ontology. And there's a Protestant Christian, his name is Hans Boersma. He's written a lot on this, on how this old way of seeing the world, just kind of how Greek philosophy was reconciled to Christian philosophy, how we regain that, how it's been lost. There's a lot of other perspectives, but theologically, that's one of them. I think there's also a really great book written by a secular philosopher. His name's Stephen Hicks. And he has a book called Explaining Postmodernism. And he, I think, does a fantastic job of dealing with the history of thought, pre-Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment, explaining how we got here.
How do you spell last name? Hans?
So Hans Boersma is B-O-E-R-S-M-A.
Comments and really appreciate your message.
Thank you so much.
I was thinking about the new generation and obviously with the modernization of our technology. The number one thing for young people right now is high suicide rate.
Mm.
And I've also heard news reports about the thing they complain most about is despair and lack of meaning. Mm. And I also heard a youth pastor talk about how their sense of reality is so altered because if it doesn't exist on their little 4-inch blue screen, they can't relate to it.
Yeah.
And Robert Zacharias, I heard him say this morning that at universities you have two categories, despair and hostility.
Mm.
And it's just amazing how you're talking about a search for meaning, and it seems like that's where the young generation is headed.
Just to comment on that, I love Ravi. He raises a great question. He says, how do we reach a generation that listens with its eyes and thinks with its feelings? It's brilliant, because he's capturing the younger generation's perspective of reality, but because of that, it's despaired. And I think part of the solution, as we kind of transitioned into this new culture and the way that we do apologetics, I think we really need to integrate the transcendentals of truth, beauty, and goodness, like the aesthetics, the beauty of God in the way that we do worship. Because I think I don't know if you've heard of Jamie K.A. Smith. He's got a great quote too. He says, we don't have countermeasures against cultural liturgies. Meaning we're all worshipers. Even a secular culture worships. But how does the church counteract that? Because what we typically do is we imitate culture's worship and just put a Christian label on it. And we don't do it as well. And so he says the answer is that we need to recapture beauty in the way that we do our own worship. And I think that can really draw the church in.
Yeah, real quick, this is one of those great coincidences. I loaned this book out to a friend who brought it back to me this right now. And it's exactly an answer to your question.
Wow.
This book is Paul and Gould. Cultural Apologetics, and the subtitle is Renewing the Christian Voice, Conscience, and Imagination in a Christian World.
Excellent.
So,
excellent.
Chris, we're out of time.
Awesome.
I can't release any more of the Dogs of War. But you've done a magnificent job. Can we give Chris a hand?
Thank you. Thank you so much for the chance to come up here and have a conversation with you guys. Appreciate it.
Lord, thank you for Chris, for inviting us, for bringing them to us, allowing us to enjoy Chris's tremendous amount of work he put into this. Please bless him as he goes through his training. Lord, give him a future that will bring many, many people to Christ. Same with his wife. Thank you so much for this couple, for the love for you, for each other, being such great models for all of us. In Jesus' name, we thank you. Amen.